KALW.
It would be cost-effective. It's a win-win-win situation. Patients win, physicians win, healthcare wins.
A fictional world explores how personal genetic records can change our healthcare.
If our genomic data is available, it's a simple mix and match.
Today, the real science behind a medical murder mystery. A conversation with author Elizabeth Reed Aden.
How do I distill this into a way that makes sense for me, that is still scientifically accurate?
Then San Francisco author Mara Cardis Nelson explores the history and damage of microfinance loans.
It's about the history of small anti-poverty loans, how those came to dominate international development, and what that means for poor borrowers around the world.
Bay Area authors exploring real-world problems. I'm Hanat Baba, and this is Cross Currents. We tailor many things for our bodies, shoes, jackets, dresses, but what about medical treatment? Today, we start by exploring the real possibilities in a fictional thriller. It's the next episode of Book It with Angie Coiro, a show about books and authors rooted in California. I'll hand it over to Angie.
Thanks, Anna. Today's book is penned by Berkeley writer Elizabeth Reed Aden. It's set in the Bay Area. The Goldilocks Genome is a scientific thriller. It is fast-moving fiction, but it's built around something very real and very slow to take hold. Medicine personalized around your DNA. The book's plot? A selfish, self-made millionaire discovers his late wife was taking antidepressants that failed her. He wreaks his revenge on the pharmaceutical industry, killing his victims with genetically targeted poison. The real mystery, though, is why the medical world, in real life, hasn't embraced care built around the Goldilocks promise. DNA-based treatments and doses that are not too much, not too little, but genetically just right. Elizabeth Reed Aden is an advisor to the SPARK program at Stanford. She used her own degree in biomedical anthropology and her subsequent years in the pharmaceutical industry to flesh out this plea within a mystery, a plea for healthcare to save billions of dollars with this ready-to-go tool. I asked Betsy, is it overstating to call this a crusade?
Probably not. I do care passionately about it because at the end of the day, pharmaceuticals and medicine, it's about people. It's about patients. It's about making lives better. And we can do this. We have the tools. We've had the tools for 20, 25 years. And it's a question of getting it implemented. And to implement it, I was just doing some work last night, to implement it, to have a full genome scan on every single person in the United States would cost the equivalent of 6% of the budget that we spend on pharmaceutical medicines in healthcare in the U.S.
That's really...
It's nothing.
I want to get into that cost-benefit analysis because that's really important, but I want to get a little bit more into personalized medicine per se so people really grasp what it is. In the book, she's taking an antidepressant that didn't work for her. And I think a lot of people have had that experience, be it antidepressant or whatever else. They find out they're in that percentage of patients for whom it doesn't work. And the response is not, well, let's find out why it didn't work for you. Let's up your dose and see if that works. And if that doesn't work, we'll add this other med next to it and see if that works. And that whole testing and testing again, that whole thing is eliminated with personalized medicine. So tell me how personalized medicine works.
So there are two ways to approach it. The first is the most complicated is to have a full genome scan. The second way is to use the single nucleotide polymorphism approach, which is little SNPs, and they're called SNPs, of genes where there's one single variant. And that's actually very effective, and it covers a lot of the disease-causing genes. So what's critical in all of this is 80% of all our prescription medicines, and actually a lot of herbs and herbal medicines and supplements, are processed by the enzymes in our liver.
Okay.
And they're highly variable, and there are a lot of them. But 50% are processed by something called cytochrome P450-3A4, like Lipitor is processed by that. The antidepressants are processed for the most part by 2D6 and to some extent 2C19. And our enzymes are highly variable. How we take that medicine and process it or metabolize it makes a difference in terms of how much of it we get. Do we get too much? Do we get too little? Or do we get it just right?
Mm-hmm.
In the case of the antidepressants, only about 40% get it about just right. The problem is then you spend 3 months trying the antidepressant, find out it really doesn't work. Then they'll either, as you said, put you on another antidepressant, or they'll move you to a benzodiazepine, which means you'll just sleep the whole time. Or they keep trying, and every time it's 3 months, 3 months, 3 months. And if you think about it, you're miserable. You're going to your doctor back and forth, back and forth. And the cost of these tests, I mean, I can get it from 23andMe for $100.
Right.
And if it's on sale, sometimes it's even less. And I can eliminate all that ambiguity with a simple test. And if I can get it right first time, why do I want to keep trying doing it one size fits all? I don't.
You know, this is what I was thinking about is, it's always hard to move the medical and pharmaceutical industries in any direction. It's turning a massive ship around. So you're talking about a cultural change to start doing it that way. But so much in medicine comes down to, for the insurance companies, for medicine, for pharmaceuticals, comes down to cost-benefit analysis. For example, we could say, if you were to do the genetic analysis on everyone and suit their medicines to them, you could save an awful lot of money. However, if you eliminate that, let's try this, let's try that, oh, let's throw in this other one, you could actually reduce the sales of some medicines. How does this play out?
You know, I did that analysis.
I'm glad.
I did that analysis back at Roche because that's what everyone said. We don't want to do that because blah, blah, blah. So let's think about this in a little bit more details, because this is something the pharmaceutical industry has actually been trying to do for 20 years. Pharmaceutical industry, ironically, is not the bad guy here. I know, hard to imagine. So if we were to do this, a couple of things happen. First of all, we're able to segment the different diseases. So, for example, all cardiovascular disease is not the same.
Okay.
Atherosclerosis can be caused by genes. It can be caused by diet. It can be caused by a number of different things. And each of those diseases that we call atherosclerosis are all treated the same. And yet they're not the same. The etiology is different, but the manifestation is similar. So from a pharmaceutical point of view, I can segment out that piece of the marketplace that is, say, genetically based atherosclerosis, or I have a marker, biomarker that says, this is indicative of my type of atherosclerosis.
Okay.
I can own that market. I can have a 50, 60, 70% market share. I don't have to be competing with a Lipitor, a Zocor, you know, anyone else. I've got that piece of the market.
Mm-hmm.
And more than that, the cost of my clinical trials goes way down. I don't have to enroll 50,000 people to show a benefit. I can do that study with, you know, 5,000 people, not 50,000 people.
So where's the road bump?
You know, it's interesting. I keep trying to figure out exactly where the road bump is. And I think part of it is the payers and part of it is physicians because they're comfortable. And that's where I have a lot of hope that AI will have a very positive impact in the prescribing physician's office. The physician will always diagnose.
Mm-hmm.
But the question is, now let's match the drug with the person. Now, the diagnostics companies probably are not too interested in this because your genome doesn't change a lot during your life.
Oh, right.
And I've had the same genetic diagnostic test done 3 different times on me. And I want you to know that the result, the answer, has not changed.
Why would they do that?
Well, because UCSF doesn't trust Kaiser, which doesn't trust UCSF, who doesn't trust, you know, 23andMe, who doesn't trust somebody else. And it's when you can get a full genome scan now at scale for between $50 to $100 versus having just now spent, you know, in theory, something close to $10,000 to get genetic information that isn't going to change. It could have been part of my record.
In terms of parsing this out, I can see one player might be dissatisfied by that, and that would be the legal profession. If you have Kaiser, for example, doesn't do their own tests, they assume that UCSF did it right in the first place, and then there comes to be some sort of claim, as far as the legal profession is concerned, well, gosh, Kaiser, sorry, you should have done your own test. We are not liable.
Yeah, I think that's fair, too. The bottom line is they all use the same third-party people. They all use the same Illumina chips. Everybody's using the same technique. It doesn't matter if it's at Quest or LabCorp. It's all pretty much the same.
That's just, it's amazing. That's just sitting out there like a plum waiting to be picked.
It is. But now Vanderbilt has taken a lead. I think they were the first in the U.S. to include, I think it's mostly SNP data, but they do have genotyped every patient in their hospital group. And they put that information into the medical record. And it's, I think it's 10 to 12 different genes that are very involved in processing drugs. And that's available. Everyone's doing that. UCSF has started to implement a program along those lines. Same for Mayo. So it's coming. Mm-hmm. It's coming, but it's slow.
Yes.
It's slow. And when you think about it, the fourth leading cause of hospital deaths are adverse events due to prescriptions, prescription meds. So a lot of that could be avoided as well.
We mentioned earlier, this is something of a crusade. This is a rightful thing to be moved into the realm of medicine, to start using that which is the most reasonable, the most efficient, the most cost-efficient, the best for the clients. And I found myself wondering why you chose to write a fiction book instead of a fact-based nonfiction. Here's what the possibilities are. Here's why it's not happening. Here's what we need to do. Tell me about the choice to make it fiction.
Oh, well, it actually goes back to NPR.
All good things go back to NPR.
Exactly.
Mostly.
So I remember I was sitting in the Stonestown parking lot, and for whatever reason, I was listening to NPR. And Irv Weissman, who was one of the founders of stem cell biology, was being interviewed. And the interviewer asked him, "How does the lay public learn about science?" And it was a simple answer. He said fiction. And I thought, oh. And it's funny. I wrote a business plan for a Canadian nonprofit about the intersection of big data, machine learning, AI, and personalized medicine. Mm-hmm. And I was talking to some different editor type people, and they said, oh, this would make a great nonfiction book, you know, pop science. But when you think about it, there are a lot of books out there already by really well-known people, Francis Collins, Michael Snyder, all these people who are gurus in the area. And nobody, to my mind, had written a good book that actually captured pharmacology, that was, in essence, a pharmacology thriller. I mean, how boring and dull does that sound? And you know, all the medical thriller books I would read, they just, you know, the FDA is all bad and everything is all bad. And I wanted to do something that was actually really positive, but took advantage of the information that I knew and I had, and that could make it very real, because up to 30% of Americans are on antidepressants. Mm-hmm. It's a big deal. It's a huge, huge market. And it's not a very well satisfied market. It's really sad.
Yes.
So I thought, okay, I know the area, I know it can be done, I understand the science, and I understand it even better now after having done a lot of Google searches. And I thought, okay, well, this is a way to spoon feed information, make it interesting, make it so that it sticks. Why did he kill her? Why did she jump? Why? And it's like, oh, I get it. Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's why.
In the early response to this, are you hearing the people glom onto the scientific possibilities as much as they are the fictional story?
They're getting it. And they're people who are not scientifically oriented or scientifically based. One of the things they say is that it makes something technical very accessible to someone who is not well-versed or even versed in biology, science, or certainly not pharmacology. Mm-hmm. And that it, they get it. They understand it. The technical pieces are accessible.
You live on a level of research and knowledge most people do not. People who pick up a murder mystery aren't necessarily going to be pharmacologists or, you know, immersed in science. Tell me how you went about making this palatable to someone who doesn't have your background.
Ironically, I don't have my background either. So I had to learn about neuroscience, and I had to make it so that I could understand it.
Mm.
And I remember my stepfather telling me that the only time you really understand something is when you can say it in 10 words or in a sentence. If you don't understand it, all of a sudden it becomes a discourse of a lot of garble and jargon and gobbledygook.
Mm-hmm.
It's a way of covering up the fact that you don't really understand the distillate. And the challenge is always, how do I distill this into a way that makes sense for me, that is still scientifically accurate? And I also had to do a lot of that when I made presentations at Roche. I would have to take these complicated things and I would use pictures and I wouldn't use these word slides, infinite word slides that bore people to freaking
yes.
death. And I would have to take the whole complex of what was it we were trying to do or what needed to be conveyed.
Mm-hmm.
If I had to rely on words, then I didn't understand the relationships between the parts and I didn't understand what was actually going on. It's hard to do. And a lot of words are kind of a cheap shot because it just covers a lot of stuff you don't know. And so if you can get to the point quickly, then you actually do know what you're doing.
This is Cross Currents. I'm Hanat Baba. We're listening to Book It with Angie Coiro. She's speaking with Berkeley author Elizabeth Reed Aden. She's written a new thriller called The Goldilocks Genome. Elizabeth's stepfather was a renowned UCSF researcher specializing in the health benefits of wine. She grew up learning about both that and wine appreciation overall. Next up in the conversation, we'll hear how alcohol impacts your body's DNA. But first, Angie and Elizabeth went down a side street. Angie asks her about last year's warning from the World Health Organization that no level of alcohol consumption can be considered safe. And now back to Angie.
Well, first of all, you don't know what the real data is that's underlying the quote evidence. So, I mean, there's a big difference from drinking one glass of wine or two glasses of wine versus a martini plus three or four glasses of wine and sharing a bottle of wine every night. What does alcohol really mean in that respect?
Mm.
So part of the problem with epidemiology is that it looks at just statistics. They don't actually spend time looking at behavior or even learning what are the real questions that you should be asking. Nobody actually goes and says, let's look at 100 families and see what actually happens and let's follow them. Let's see how they really use wine. Instead, they rely on how many glasses of wine do you drink a night when you go to the doctor? Oh, how many per week? And it's a rough estimate at best. And people may overestimate, they may underestimate. Hard liquor is different from wine. Hard liquors are different from, you know, there's a whole range and a whole spectrum. And we tend to lump all of that together. Beer is different from wine. So
now, you know, that's counter what we're taught as kids, because we're being taught about drinking and driving. Alcohol is alcohol. You know, it doesn't matter whether you're ingesting it through beer or through wine or through alcohol. Alcohol is alcohol, period. So it sounds like maybe that's not the case.
Well, 3% beer is different from 12% wine, which is different from 50% something else, which is different from, you know, what is it, Ronrico 161 proof. Those are different.
Yes, yes. Beaujolais versus Everclear. I get it. Yes.
So, and that's part of what happens is I guess the PR, whoever it is, says, let's make the message simple.
Mm-hmm.
So something is all bad or all good. And nuance is hard for people to deal with. So hopefully people, as they grow up, learn that there are differences. You can handle two beers a lot differently than you handle two bottles of wine.
Yes.
But to say everything is bad or everything is one way or another is usually not accurate. It's just very extreme. And the idea is somehow we're appealing to, you know, some idiot masses somewhere. And it's like, okay, well, I'll ignore that.
That isn't capable of discriminating.
Exactly.
Right. Right. You know, wine also figures into, I want to bring this back to genetics, because alcohol, the ingestion of alcohols and how it's processed, that also has a genetic element. I came across something that I didn't believe, which was that gastric surgery, you know, gastric bypass, whatever, up to 30% of people who have a gastric surgery for weight loss may end up with problematic alcohol behaviors. And because I was reading the book at the same time, I thought to myself, is that a genetic aptitude? Because genetics and alcohol processing have a ton to do with each other.
Yes. And how you process alcohol dehydrogenase is completely different. And there are ethnic differences. So that Asians tend to not be able to process alcohol. Other people can just keep going and going. And I'm waiting for the buzz. I'm waiting for the buzz. And the Asian's like, whoa, excuse me, that buzz is here. And I have had 1 ounce. So it is different, and there are genetic differences, and those would all be available if we had our genome scan. And then I ran into one woman who had done 23andMe and had figured all this out, and she said, you know, she had a printout of the key genes, and she was in the emergency room, and someone came in, the doctor came in and said, oh, well, antibiotic, we're giving you this one. She goes, how is this processed? And he said, I don't know. Let me see the package insert. Okay, those are all available. And she looked at it and says, I can't take this drug. And he goes, no, just take it. I can't take this drug.
Wow.
Because it's going to cause problems. I'm going to get severe side effects. I will not take this drug. Find an alternative.
Nice.
And the bottom line is, physicians aren't trained in pharmacology and they aren't trained in genetics.
Do you think that has to change?
You know, I think the reality is, I think AI is going to take that part over, because it's simply a question of mixing and matching.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the package inserts are all available online. It's simple to get that information and have that available. If our genomic data is available, it's a simple mix and match.
This is fascinating.
It's absolutely simple. It is a no-brainer.
Yeah. Yeah. Would be such a massive change from such a simple thing.
And it would be cost effective. It's a win-win-win situation. Patients win, physicians win, healthcare wins. We save money on our budget that's going, healthcare expenditures that are going crazy. I mean, we could reduce our healthcare costs by at least 30% if we implemented this.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
That's Angie Coiro with our featured series, Book It. Her guest this week was Elizabeth Reed Aden, author of the new thriller, The Goldilocks Genome. It discusses medical care specific to each person's DNA. We'll have more information at kalw.org/crosscurrents. You're listening to Cross Currents from KALW News. I'm Hanat Baba. Next, we'll go to another Bay Area author. We're going from the promise of medicine to the perils of microfinance. It's a reading from New Arrivals, our pocket-sized book tour. Author Mara Cardis Nelson lives in San Francisco and wrote the book, We Are Not Able to Live in the Sky, The Seductive Promise of Microfinance.
It's about the history of small anti-poverty loans, how those came to dominate international development, and what that means for poor borrowers around the world. Here's an excerpt from a section that takes place with women microfinance borrowers in Sierra Leone, West Africa. Hello? Moose's voice rose with the O. To Yabum on the other end, Old Post sounded so tantalizingly close. She could hear the high-pitched squeal of kids, the rooster who only crowed when the time wasn't right, spoons scraping the bottom of emptying pots. She could see from her spot at the police counter that it was that in-between hour. Finally, it would be cool enough for the boys at the soccer pitch to play, but still warm enough for the bars to put on some music and entice the few people with money to buy beers. But Yabum needed one more thing done today. Please, she said into the phone to Musu, I'm begging you. Years later, Musu wouldn't be able to remember how much information Yabum had offered on the call, whether she knew where she was going or for how long. Maybe Yabum had known and just hadn't told Musu the details. She just called me to ask me to take care of the kids. That's it. I don't know if Yabum went to Freetown or went to the barracks. All I know is that the two kids are here with me. I've never seen her again.
That was author Mara Cardis Nelson reading from the book We Are Not Able to Live in the Sky, The Seductive Promise of Microfinance. It came out in June. New Arrivals is produced by Lisa Morehouse. You can find more readings from Bay Area authors at klw.org/newarrivals. Today's Cross Currents team includes Hussein Khan, Arun Nair, Julia Haney, Nigar Ajayabi, James Rowlands, Gonadi Joe Johnson, Victor Tense, Molly Blair Salyer, Shireen Adil, Angela Johnston, Marissa Ortega Welch, Sunni Khalid, and Ben Trefney. Our opening theme music is by the John Santos Quintet, as interpreted by Daoud Anthony. For Cross Currents, I'm Hanat Baba.